Welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Got a good show for you this week. 12-year NBA vet, 4-time All-Star, and the cleanest trash talker you're ever going to meet, Mark Price, joins the show. He's also the head coach over at UNC Charlotte. I ask Mark about his relationship with Craig Elo, the aftermath of the loss to the Bulls in the 89 playoffs, and the art behind reconstructing a player's jump shot. All right, let's go.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
My guest this week is a 12-year NBA veteran, a 4-time All-Star. He's got a gold medal from the 1994 World Championships, and he is one of the best free throw shooters in NBA history. It's Mark Price, who is now coaching at UNC Charlotte, the head coach of the 49ers. But Mark, is great free throw shooter the first line on your basketball playing epitaph?
Well, I don't know, but it's one that people put up there pretty high, I guess.
When you were playing, how many teammates during seasons or before seasons or after or in the off season would come up to you and say, you got to help me with my free throw shooting?
I had quite a few teammates ask me for some tips along the way and ask for my opinion on ways that they might could get better. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, when you finish practice, coach sends you the goals, usually a couple guys at a basket to shoot free throws. And a lot of times guys would fight to come shoot with me. Maybe they might pick up something.
who did you help, though? Like, was there one of your teammates where you look back and say, man, I might have been able to make a bit of an impact there?
Yeah, actually, a guy I played with quite a bit, Brad Doherty, who was, you know, he's a great player and, you know, was always looking to get better. And Brad would always pick my brain and try to help him. And I adjusted a couple little things with his free throw, and he seemed to like the improvements. So he was one guy, obviously, that I played with for a long time that I was able to help a little bit.
Yeah, you and Brad were the same draft, right?
We were. We got to play together for 7 years in Cleveland.
You were. He was the first overall pick that year. You were 25th, right? The first pick in the second round.
That's right.
Imagine 25 in a draft now. That would you'd be first round money in today's drafts, Mark?
It's a lot more money too. By the way,
you got tagged with the white guy criticism coming out of college, didn't you? Like, you know, you just how is he ever going to be able to compete with these athletes in the NBA?
Well, you know, the small, slow, white guy syndrome, I kind of got lumped in. The problem was anybody that ever played against me knew that I wasn't slow. So, you know, I just, you know, kind of had to overcome that most of my career, you know, even going into college. You know, I wasn't going to be a big-time college player because I was too small and didn't look the part, you know. But I was able to overcome that and have a good career, you know, at Georgia Tech and in the ACC and take that on to the NBA where a lot of people had doubts. I really felt like I should have been a first-round pick that year. But, you know, once again, I think there were some people worried I wouldn't be able to make that transition to the NBA level.
What were your draft workouts like?
Well, it's funny because, you know, back when I came out, you didn't really have those kind of workouts, you know, much. At least I didn't. Most of the guys used to go to Hawaii. The top seniors every year would go to Hawaii and play, and I wasn't even able to go to that because I was like a quarter from graduating at Georgia Tech, and so I wanted to stay and get my degree before I left. And so, you know, I'd never really had any workouts. You know, I felt that, you know, I'd played in the best basketball conference in the country in the ACC for 4 years. Just about every point guard I played against in college went on to play in the league, and so I felt like I had a pretty good body of work for them to see me and see what I was able to do.
When you look at the first 24 teams that drafted, that passed on you the first time around, was there a team that passed on you that most disappointed you, that you were like, I would have been a great fit there, I thought they were going to take me?
Well, yeah, and it was, to me, in my mind, it was a no-brainer because obviously being at Georgia Tech, the Atlanta Hawks had the 20th pick that year, and they had a team of fantastic athletes with guys like Dominique Wilkins and Cliff Levingston and Antoine Carr and all those guys. And, you know, really that knockdown shooter was something that they really needed to add to their team. But for some reason, they ended up drafting, I think his name was Ken Barlow, who never even put on a Hawks uniform, I don't think. So, you know, I was a little disappointed because that would have been fantastic, obviously, playing my college career in Atlanta. I was familiar with the Hawks and felt like I would have been a perfect fit there, but for some reason they passed on me.
See, that's a whiff. That's a big time whiff. If you're the pro team and this guy's playing in your backyard, like, you got to be able to see you and see you play and realize that you could play at that level.
Well, you'd think so. You'd think so, but yeah, as far as I'm concerned, it was a big whiff also.
When you got to the NBA, I mean, was it fast, you know, for you when you first got to the league? And if it was, I mean, how did you compensate as a college player going pro?
Well, I think the thing that helped me, obviously, was my ability to shoot the ball and to shoot the ball with range, you know, with the three-point line. See, most people don't realize that I didn't even have a three-point line in college. I actually got put in full-time. The ACC was the first conference to, you know, try the three-point shot out when I was a freshman. And I led the league in scoring as a freshman because of it. They took it out, and then the NCAA put it in the year after I left. So I never played with the three-point line really at the college level. And so, you know, that was a real advantage for me going into the NBA level and going in at a time in the NBA where, you know, point guard position wasn't really a scoring position at that time. You only had a couple guys like Magic Johnson and Isaiah Thomas that were really scorers from the point guard position. So, you know, I think particularly with Lenny Wilkins being the coach and being a great point guard, he saw the advantage of having somebody that could shoot the ball like I could and as an advantage of playing the point guard position.
When there is no three-point line for you at college, I mean, how do you prepare yourself for the NBA? Do you just spend as much time as possible between the draft and the end of your season just jacking up threes from the NBA line?
You know, you practice and spend time doing it, but, you know, I was shooting from three-point range even in college, even though there wasn't a line out there on the floor because of my ability to shoot defenses. You know, I had to kind of extend my range to be able to get shots off at times. So, you know, it wasn't that much of a stretch getting used to it. Obviously, I spent a lot more time once I, you know, got with Cleveland that first year. I was actually a backup to John Bagley. And so, you know, just spent a lot of time in practice, after practice, whatever, practice, you know, hoisting up threes and getting comfortable with the distance.
You were actually part of what may be one of the greatest second-round draft classes ever. You remember the guys that were in your draft class in the second round?
I do. Some of them. You know, I know, you know, we had Johnny Newman was in that class. Mm-hmm. I believe Dennis Rodman was in that class.
You got Nate McMillan was there as well. Jeff Hornacek, yep. Kevin Duckworth, and Larry Krystowiak. That's a pretty good team in that second round.
Yeah, we all did all right.
When the Cavaliers selected you, you know, it turned into a stable situation with you there, Brad, Lenny as the coach. But at that time, I mean, they were kind of a mess coming into that. I think they had been to one playoff appearance in the last 6 years, had a whole bunch of coaches between 80 and 86. I mean, it was the whole Ted Stepien thing had gone on prior to that. I mean, what did you think about going to Cleveland?
Well, I think you know, their nickname was kind of the Cadavers at the time, I think. A lot of people called them that. And I didn't know a whole lot about Cleveland, to be honest, at the time. But we had an unbelievable draft group. Not only Brad at one, but Ron Harper was drafted at number 7. I was picked up at 25. We got Johnny Newman as well later in the second round. But then Hot Rod Williams was sitting there as well, who didn't get to play the year before because of some things the NBA was looking in with him. And so, you know, that's a pretty darn good draft class coming in as rookies that first year. And we missed the playoffs my first year there. But after that, we never missed them again. And so it was quite a quick turnaround. And, you know, a lot of talent came in with that one draft.
Yeah, it turned into a really good young team from the start, and you guys really did develop from there. You mentioned playing for Lenny Wilkins, one of the all-time great coaches, an all-time you know, good, very good player back in his day at your position as well. How much, if at all, did having him there and him being familiar with your position, how much did that help you early on?
Well, it helped me a lot because, you know, when I was at Georgia Tech, even though I was, you know, the point guard, I had to score a lot, you know, at the college level for us to be successful. So, you know, a lot of people might have said I was I was almost more of a two guard and a point guard body, and so Lenny took that ability that I had to shoot the basketball and score the ball, and began to teach me the nuances of the point guard position, which he knew I could develop and learn those. The way I shot the ball, it's hard to develop and learn how to do that very quickly. So, you know, I think, it was great that I got to go in as a young player and learn from, a Hall of Fame player.
Yeah, I didn't get the chance to cover Lenny until the very end of his coaching career, largely in New York. But he didn't strike me as a much of a screamer. He seems more soft-spoken. Was he a screamer? Did he get on guys? I mean, what was his personality?
Now, Lenny was great. He wasn't a screamer, but he was, very competitive person. Our personalities are really similar in a lot of ways, and I think that's probably why we, got along so well and worked so well together. But, Lenny just was a big believer in treating guys like professionals, and, if there was something he needed to talk to you about, he'd call you into his office or pull you aside and just have a man-to-man, one-on-one conversation with you. It was never, he would never try to embarrass a guy in front of his teammates. And I think that's, why guys love playing for him and respected him so much.
Yeah, you both do seem to have kind of that similar, even-keeled type of personality. I was reading something about what Jordan once said about you, specifically when it comes to when you get fired up on the court. You're not a cursor. It's kind of what you were in your careers. Jordan said something along the lines of, I don't know why is when you got thrown out of one of your games. I think you were thrown out twice in your playing career. Jordan said something like, "Yeah, I don't know how we got thrown out. Mark doesn't curse." two questions on that. Number one, do you remember the two ejections that you had, and what were they for?
Yeah, I do remember them clearly because obviously there was only two. But I remember getting a technical for something that was some weird kind of situation. It was something I didn't deserve a technical for. And that upset me so bad that I basically just went over to the ref and said, "Well, if you're going to give me a technical, at least give me one that I deserve." And so he gave me the second one and threw me out pretty much. And the second one was I just got frustrated in the game. A guy had set an illegal pick, and I basically just grabbed him by the jersey and threw him down on the floor and kind of got ejected for that. But, that was pretty much the extent of my getting kicked out of games.
What was I'm trying to imagine a Mark Price trash talk. Because there's a lot of trash talk goes on in the NBA. What does a Mark Price trash talk sound like?
Well, you got to be creative, I guess. You're not going to cuss at somebody, but I've talked a little more trash than people probably realize, and whether it be telling a guy or talking to a coach or, I didn't usually get into the trash talking much until somebody started doing it to me. And then, I did a couple shots on them and asked them how they liked it or something like that. Or, who knows? It was usually in fun and in jest when I started doing it.
Who was the guy, the opponent, that went at you with the talk the most?
It's funny because I guess it's because I didn't really, instigate trash talking that, guys didn't really do it that much to me. I don't know if it's the respect or, I think I had a little bit of reputation and guys start talking trash. That kind of got me fired up and I played better. So maybe it was more of like a, leave a sleeping giant alone, because I remember in college all the time, guys would start trash talking and John Sally, who was my teammate at Georgia Tech, would say, "Well, you're going to regret saying that." And then, it would tick me off and I'd go at them even harder. So, I didn't get a lot, but, a guy, one of the trash talkers that came into the league at a young age, Gary Payton, he liked to talk a lot. Of course, Reggie Miller was in the league and he liked to talk. And, although we didn't, do a lot of trash talking back and forth, a big rivalry was, Detroit and Isaiah Thomas. And so we always had some epic battles going back and forth at each other, even though it wasn't a lot of trash talk. It was a pretty intense rivalry.
I'm trying to imagine what the Mark Price, Gary Payton matchup looks like, just verbally, not basketball-wise. Verbally, what does it look like?
Well, Gary just, he likes to talk and everything. I most of the time, I probably you know, I usually diffused it because I just kind of ignored him, you know, for the most part, and just played my game. That was more of my style. So, you know, but most of the time, if I'd hit a shot on him, I'd probably give some of it back to him or whatever. But he probably did a lot more of the talking than I did.
Well, Gary was – there was nobody Gary wouldn't talk trash to. I mean, Gary talked to – you know, when he was, when George Karl was coaching him, he was yelling at Karl on the sideline for half the game. I mean, it wasn't just opponents he was yelling at.
Yeah, Gary, he liked to hear the sound of his voice. So he was always saying something to somebody.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Peter King here, reminding you to subscribe and listen to all new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, as well as the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer and the 10 Things MMQB Podcast.
And now a word from Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. Fast, powerful, and completely online, Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts out of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. Hate searching through stacks of old files and paperwork? With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button, helping you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your unique financial situation. Even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all this on your phone or tablet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/Mannix. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
You mentioned those Cavaliers teams, a lot of success, but best known for those matchups and that one match in particular with Chicago. I'm curious, the last time that you talked to Craig Elo was when?
After Kyrie Irving hit the shot for Cleveland to win it this year, I called him and I said, "We got a new shot in town. Maybe they'll forget about yours."
He seems to have really rolled with the – we had him on my radio show a little while back, and he just seems to be – he rolls with it. Like, there's nothing that sticks with him when it comes to that shot. He's very much over it and, you know, kind of has some fun with it.
Well, that's just Craig, and that's how he played as a player too. You know, he was a defender, and to be a quote-unquote good defender in the NBA means – guys score a lot of points on you, even though if you're a good defender, because guys are so good. So, you know, you just have to learn to kind of roll with it. And I used to be with him, and people would ask him that question, you know, what was it like? And Craig was just like, shoot, that shot made me famous. So that was just always his kind of approach to it. And so, I definitely gave him a call after the Cavs won it this year and told him, hey, man, the heat's off. Kyrie just made a great shot, change it in Cleveland history.
Well, what people forget about that play against the Bulls was that, correct me if I'm wrong, but Craig scored the basket right before that. So he was a hero for about a minute and a half. And then the final 3 seconds happened, and all of a sudden it changes history.
No question. It was, and that people do not realize, unless they actually see that game on a replay, that we were actually down by one with 6 seconds to go. And, he throws it into Larry Nance, dives straight to the basket for a layup. Jordan turned his head, and Craig laid it in. So, you know, if Michael doesn't hit the shot, he's probably the GOAT instead of the hero. And so it's amazing the twists and turns of all what happened within a six-second period.
What do you remember about that play in particular? I mean, when you see it on TV and you watch it, the clips come out, I mean, what goes through your mind?
Well, I just, you know, I thought it was just a great player hitting an unbelievable shot. You know, you couldn't have defended it much better. I mean, Michael jumps up to shoot, and he actually has to hold, you know, hang in the air and wait for Craig to go by him until he releases the shot. So it was just an unbelievable play by a great player. And you know, we tried to double team him. Larry Nance tried to help and not let him catch it, but he still somehow was able to come out and get the ball and make the shot.
Yeah, people look at the athletes in today's game, and there are great athletes in the NBA today, but you're right about that shot. I mean, it wasn't just a contested shot. It was, you know, hanging in the air for 3-4 seconds, you know, fading a little bit to the left in that one. I mean, it was as tough a shot as you could possibly make in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it really was. Like I said, you know, Craig got back in the play, and, you know, if Michael shoots it normally, Craig probably blocks it, you know, but he hangs on to it, lets Craig go by, and then releases it on the way down. So it was the degree of difficulty on that shot was was really high.
What do you remember about the locker room after that game? I mean, obviously there's incredible disappointment, but was it different than other losing locker rooms that you've been in the past?
Oh yeah, that one by far was the most devastating feeling, just because the other side note that people don't realize was we beat Chicago six times that
year. That's right.
Regular season. We were a better team than they were, you know, we really were. And yet on that one day, you know, Michael was the best player in the world and made an unbelievable shot. But, you know, so it definitely, when you know or believe that you have the better team and then you lose in that sort of fashion, that was obviously extremely disappointing for all of us.
Was there fallout from that? I mean, did the hangover from that loss affect you guys moving forward?
Well, the fallout was, you know, Cleveland after that, you know, made the decision to trade Ron Harper.
Yeah.
And, you know, bring Danny Ferry in. And so there was definitely a fallout. Obviously, if we win that game, then, you know, there's probably a good chance that that trade never happens. And you know, we keep that team intact. So there was definitely, you know, that was the biggest probably fallout from it.
But is there going to be like a Bill Buckner in Boston kind of moment in Cleveland this year? Remember when the Red Sox broke the curse of their World Series stretch? They brought Buckner back in. Are they going to bring like Elo back and have a ceremony next year in Cleveland for him?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything about that. But, you know, they should, as far as I'm concerned, bring it back and get rid of the curse.
To me, it changes the narrative, right? You know, Cleveland is now, they won a championship. All is forgotten, forgiven. Everything's now just part of the journey, right? It's all just part of the process.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, you had to go through, you know, parts B and C to get to Z. So, you know, that was part of the process.
Do your kids at UNC Charlotte, do they ask about that moment? Are they even aware of it, given their age?
You know, they're aware of it just because, you know, they're all into basketball and NBA TV. It seems like at least once a year they put that game on, you know, the shot. And so, you know, I get texts all the time from guys that I've coached on every level. Coach, I'm watching you play on TV. And, you know, I keep saying, well, did we win this time?
Did your kids think they could take you? Like they see you out on the floor, you know, 6'1", 6'2", whatever it is, you know, the white guy stuff. Do they think they could have taken you?
Well, I doubt that they think they could have taken me back in the day when I was their age. But they certainly look at me now and think they can take me. You know, I'm 53 years old. They certainly could probably take me right now.
You've branched out into coaching. You know, first as a shooting coach, then NBA assistant, and now obviously with your college job. I'm curious, as a coach, what do you think is teachable in young players and what's not teachable?
Well, I think, obviously there's a lot that's teachable. I think, you know, I think there's certain guys that come along that have certain, you know, natural skill set that they have, or a term I like to use all the time, a feel for the game, maybe that's not quite teachable. I think different parts of the game, different skills you can teach. You can help a guy learn to shoot a little bit better. You can help them improve their free throw shooting. You can help them improve their defense. But can you make a guy a world-class shooter? You know, I don't know that you can just make anybody that. You know, like I said, certain guys, you just put a ball in their hands and they seem to just make the right plays. They have a feel for the game. You know, can you necessarily teach that? You can show guys things and help them to get better, but there's certain guys that, you know, if you know what I'm talking about, they just kind of make the game seems to be a little bit easier for them than others.
I feel like it's when it comes to shooting in particular, it's a blend. It's what a coach or a shooting coach or whatever can show you to do, and a player's commitment to do it. I look at Kawhi Leonard and what he's done in San Antonio. I mean, Chip Englund out there changed his shot when he came out of San Diego State. Kawhi bought into it. Now he's, you know, I think elite is the right word, perimeter shooter. I mean, is that a fair assessment that if you have a guy that is completely committed to doing this, that they can, you know, completely alter the way they play?
Well, no question about it, particularly when you're talking about the elite kind of athletes that you're dealing with at the NBA level. You know, they're obviously extremely talented and gifted, and if they really buy into change, and I think that's always the challenge. You know, when I worked with Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, you know, a couple years ago with the Hornets, you know, it was going to be a major overhaul to try to change his shot. And, you know, my first question to him when we started together was basically, you need to let me know when you want to get this thing fixed because of the commitment that it's going to take to do it. And, you know, when he came and said, I'm ready, I want to get this thing done. And, you know, he put the time and the effort and listened and bought in. And, you know, guys that are that gifted athletically are able to do those kinds of things. It might be a little bit tougher than just the average guy trying to do it.
How big a challenge was Kidd-Gilchrist? Because we knew what he was coming out of Kentucky. There was a major hitch in that shot. But when you, you know, sort of really started to dissect him, was it as big a challenge as it looked like from the outside?
Yeah, it was a challenge. It was probably, you know, from a shooting coach perspective, it was one of the biggest challenges that I'd ever looked at. And, you know, it was, you know, he was unbelievable. He's got a great attitude. He's a great person. Like I said, he listened to me. I basically said, you can only listen to one guy. That's going to be me. We're going to get this thing right. But, you know, it's going to be some difficult days. And anytime you're totally reconstructing a shot, there's going to be days where, you know, you got good days, you got bad days, and then you're going to reach that point where it's like, okay, you can go either way. Are we going to get over this hump, or are you going to kind of just succumb to I'm more comfortable doing it my way? So we met and dealt with all those situations, and, you know, to Mike's credit, he was so determined to get it better that, you know, he was able to get over that hump, and it really paid off for him.
Yeah, Chip Englund said something to me that I remember now, was that he said a shot is really personal for a guy, and getting him to change it is difficult. Has that been your experience, that, you know, guys are, especially when they come into the NBA, are kind of wed to their jump shot, and it is difficult to get them to make sweeping changes to it?
Yeah, it's a comfort level, and, you know, particularly when you're talking about a guy that's made it to the NBA, you know, you're always dealing with the, you know, the pride factor of, hey, I'm already pretty darn good player, or I wouldn't be in the NBA, you know. So, you know, it really comes down to that personal, you know, challenge of, hey, I want to grow, I want to reach my full potential. I'm willing to take on the tough task to get myself to another level. And, yeah, it is a personal thing. And a lot of guys want to do it for different reasons. And so, you know, dealing with that part of it is always a challenge as well.
We haven't seen a full season from Mike in a couple of years now because of the injuries, but from what you've seen and the work he's done and the work you guys had done together, do you see him becoming a three-point shooter? I mean, do you see that being a part of his repertoire at some point?
Yeah, I think if he keeps progressing, I know early on last year he had taken more threes than he ever had in his life, you know, just the little time that he had played last season. And so, you know, it's definitely, that's the next step for him to increase his range and, you know, continue to work on that. I don't know, you know, we'll see if he's ever to the point where you consider him, you know, a legitimate three-point threat night in, night out. But, you know, but if he continues to work on it, he could definitely add that, you know, next step to his game.
How much did you work with Rajon Rondo?
Actually, it wasn't a real long period of time. I was actually at the time, you know, I put together a shooting lab in Atlanta, and a lot of the pro teams were sending me guys, and Rajon came in one summer. So I basically just worked with him over a summer. And, you know, we actually got a lot accomplished and, you know, with him when he came in. So, you know, but I only worked with him for one summer.
Have you watched him subsequent? Because there were a couple of years, and I'm not sure when you work with him, but he was in the mid-60s with his free throw shooting for a couple of years.
Right.
And then he sort of fell off a cliff, and he's been down in that, you know, 30% range, 58 last year in Sacramento. I don't know how much you've seen of him and how he's shooting free throws, but I mean, how would you assess what he's been doing?
Yeah, you know, to be honest, lately, you know, obviously being at the college level and everything, I haven't paid as much attention to the NBA as I normally would. And with Rajon kind of moving out to the West Coast, I haven't seen a lot of their games. But, yeah, when I was working with him, we had gotten him up and he had improved, showed quite a bit of improvement. So I don't know if he's kind of slipped back to old habits or what's going on with him. But, you know, I haven't really watched him enough to be able to give a, you know, really an assessment of it.
Well, how big a change did you try to make with his shot, say, compared to what you did with Kidd Gilchrist?
Well, it wasn't quite as major of a overhaul as MKG. There were just certain things. And, you know, when you're only with a guy for, you know, short periods of time, you always try to find a couple things that you know, you can try to help him with that'll help improve. And I thought we did that with some of his footwork and just his release point and things like that on his shot. But, you know, if we'd have been able to spend more time, you know, I might have been able to pick up on a few other things as well.
God, he would be so good if he were a, you know, 38% consistent three-point shooter and a 75, 80% free throw shooter. The guy's, he'd be like a 20-12 guy out there.
Yeah, he's really talented. And, you know, just from that standpoint, working with him, you know, it's hard to sometimes, you know, you feel for a guy, you know, because he is so talented that things become, you know, it gets to a point where it becomes really mental, you know, when you talk about shooting in those situations.
So you were on the kind of NBA track for a while. You're doing some assistant work. You work with Stan Van Gundy. You work with Steve Clifford down in Charlotte. What made you want to do the college thing, to be a college coach?
Well, I don't know that it was that I necessarily just wanted to do the college thing. I really believed I was ready to be a head coach, and you know, whatever form or fashion that presented itself, that I felt like was a good fit for me, and just so happened that this opportunity at Charlotte popped up kind of out of the blue while I was working with the Hornets. And so, you know, not only did it provide me an opportunity to be a head coach at, you know, Division I level in college, but you know, it was right here in Charlotte in my backyard, and so it was a good situation for my family, not having to uproot and move, and so it was kind of the best of both worlds in that opportunity. So, you know, I took it, and you know, I've really enjoyed it. You know, I was ready to try to run my own program and do those kinds of things, and it's been a lot of fun and a lot of work, but I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, you clearly enjoy the teaching part of the game. Was it an adjustment, all the other stuff that came into the college experience, most notably, you know, recruiting, which is such a huge part of being a college coach?
Yeah, no question. The college game is, you know, there's a lot more irons in the fire, so to speak, you know, when you're a coach at the college level. Just, you mentioned the recruiting part. You know, you have to go out, travel, you have to talk guys into coming, playing for you, and trying to build your program that way, but you also have the academic side of things, and you're probably more personally responsible for your players. You know, at the pro level, it's a job, and guys kind of have their own people around them, and they do their work and go home. But you know, at the college level, it's kind of like you're responsible for these young men. Their parents are giving them to you to not only, you know, help them with their basketball, but you know, academically, making sure that you help prepare them for life and success after basketball. So, you know, it's a big responsibility, but it's something that I really, really am enjoying right now, getting a chance to have a real positive impact on these young men that come and play for me.
Now, do you enjoy all that you just talked about, the entire college experience, more than just, say, the professional experience where it is simply 24/7 kind of coaching?
Well, I don't know that I enjoy it more. It's just different. It's a different, you know, it's a different animal, you know, and I loved getting out on the floor every day and spending, you know, 3-4 hours a day really teaching the guys at the pro level and trying to help them improve and get better and coaching and learning, you know, the ropes as an NBA coach, but getting a chance to deal with guys at the college level is a challenge and fun. It's just, it's just different. But I love both of them.
What do you remember about your your first recruiting trip?
Well, I remember it clearly because one of the guys that I hired to be my top guy, he's been a long time college guy and been in the business for about 28 years, and he kind of took me around and showed me the ropes. And I remember going to one of these big, huge AAU tournaments, and there's about 500 teams playing, and and I didn't know which kid was who. You know, I hadn't been following the college game that closely, and in particular high school for sure. You know, so I'm going out, and you know, he was saying, which guys do you like? They kind of had some players, and I would start picking guys out, and he would say, well, we can't get him because he's, you know, one of the top 10 players in the country. And I said, well, at least I know what talent looks like. So
you're looking at the Kentucky guys, the guys Calipari's looking at. Yeah, like, yeah, we'll take him. He can play for me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, don't go to Kentucky. They got a bunch of guys. Come play at Charlotte. You know, we'll have a good time.
How far does the Mark Price name go in living rooms when you're recruiting these kids?
Well, I feel like it's you know, it's a real advantage, and you know, I'll be honest, I mean, a lot of these kids, they don't really know who I am. Reference point of it, other than most of them say, "Yeah, I've played you on 2K before." So I'm more known as a guy on a video game right now with these kids.
You make every shot, every three-point shot.
Yeah, that's what I hear. I'm pretty good on 2K, I guess. But you know, their parents all know who I am, and so they kind of fill the kids in and give them my background. Of course, you can, you know, pull up YouTube and see me playing a little bit there, so it gives them a little bit of a reference point. But it's been a real asset for me. I haven't had any trouble getting in front of kids and their parents, and when I'm coming to talk to them about Charlotte.
So 5 years from now, what do you think you're doing?
You know, that's for the good Lord to know. You know, I'm kind of a guy that just takes it day by day. I don't, you know, I'm loving coaching. You know, what opportunities down the road. I'm really happy here at Charlotte. I want to build something really special here, and it's you know, I'm not a guy that looks out too far down the road, to be honest with you. I know that you know, if I'm doing the right things and I'm working hard and I'm doing a good job, then there's always going to be opportunities out there. But you know, I'm really happy here in Charlotte. It's a great city. I love the school, and it's you know, I'm really enjoying it right now.
Do you have a no cursing rule for your kids on the floor?
You know, they don't hear it from me, but you know, it's going to slip from time to time. I'm not too hard on them, you know. But we definitely have a way we like to do things, a program, and you know, I want that to reflect who I am and the way I want things done. But I can guarantee you one thing: we play hard. You know, they follow that example for sure. We get after people and we grow and we get better, and we're trying to teach these young men how to play the game and how to be responsible in the classroom and try to be successful in life. And that's what's exciting about this job.
You got to give me the best clean Mark Price trash talk, because I'm just sort of kicking around ideas of what it could be in my head, like the cleanest Mark Price trash talk during his playing days. Is there like you stink, man? Like you're terrible, or I'm better than you? I made that shot. Like I'm. What do you got for me, Mark?
Well, I can tell you this, and I'll let you in. This is an inside the halftime talk last year. Okay,
all right.
And this will give you a little bit of feel. We play a horrible. We're playing. We were playing Rice at home, and it was a point in our year we were kind of turning our season around, and I wasn't happy with our guys, and I didn't know what to say to them coming in. I was really upset, and I'm in there, and I say, you know what, guys? You guys are just a bunch of cream puffs, okay? So I throw out the term cream puffs. Of course, I look, and my assistants are doing all they can not to start laughing, you know, and I think the players were too, but it offended them so much. They were like, Coach, I would have rather had you cuss at me than call me a cream puff. And so we go out, and we score 66 points in the next half and win the game, so... You know, for what it's worth, cream puffs works in a pep talk. So there you go.
Well, Mark, I appreciate you taking some time to talk to me here. Best of luck this season and with all your success and everything moving forward.
Well, I appreciate it, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity.
That's it. My thanks to Mark Price for joining the show. As always, you can download this podcast and other archive podcasts on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, check out the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and the Vertical Podcast with Woj. Don't forget, if you like this episode and if you like this podcast in general, feel free to give us a rating, leave a comment. You know I appreciate it. See you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.